Episode 2, as we pick up on some of the ideas Darcis floated in his latest book, Fortune's Fool, Australia's Choices, published by Monash, as a part of their wonderful In the National Interest series. And tonight he joins us once more, this time to take a look at China. Big economic shifts underway in the People's Republic, and Darcis argues that we need to be aware of them, given how they might shape our own fortunes. Great to have you back. China has been described as the world's economic miracle. What's been the secret?
Well, I think one thing that people need to remember is an apocryphal story about Deng Xiaoping, which I think is in one of his biographies. When he acceded to power, he was going off to the United Nations, and he asked how much in the way of US dollars China had to finance the trip. I think it was something like $38,000. Now, that country, which in, say, 1980 had a GDP per capita of just a few hundred US dollars, the GDP per capita, which is not a particularly good measure, but a useful one in some senses, is now over $10,000. So yeah, it is an economic miracle, but it's still relatively low compared to developed countries, because that $10,000 is something like a quarter or even less than what people earn in developed countries. But the growth model they had is actually not a mystery. It's the one that Japan and Germany and other countries adopted in the post-war period, which is you use your natural resources and size. And in particular, I think, I can't remember, it was Charles de Gaulle, I think, who instinctively understood this when he said China is a big country inhabited by many Chinese. And I think they leveraged
that. He was
that.
No fool.
No, he was no fool. So they leveraged their natural resources, which is a lot of people, low wages, high savings, and basically tried to get capital to invest and basically build their whole economy around exports. And China was very successful in this. They became the world's factory. They imported in raw materials and components, then they processed and assembled them for export. And that sort of sets off a virtuous cycle. So they improved living standards. They brought people from the countryside, surplus labor, into the city and urbanization. They got foreign investment. But one underestimated part of that is the return of a very large Chinese diaspora. They have a name for it, Haigu, or sea turtles. They all went back to the motherland supplying capital and skills. And I think that was quite important in growing China.
Okay, we saw some cracks starting to emerge with the Evergrande saga last year. What are some of the problems China is facing now?
Well, I think last year's problems were really something that went back to about 2008 and the GFC. China literally stopped in 2007, 2008, and there was a prospect of mass unemployment and social instability. And what happened was the downturn forced China to try to revive its stellar growth by using massive investment programs funded by borrowing, mainly from their government-controlled banks. And the World Bank, I think, a couple of years ago, actually had a look at this, and they actually found that almost all of China's economic growth was driven by what they called, in this rather disingenuous phrase, state-influenced expenditure. But the problems, I think, are quite deep. The growth is grossly overstated because of it's all debt-driven. Their debt is now very, very large. And essentially, a lot of that debt went into massive overinvestment, mainly in industrial overcapacity.
Well, you talk about Ozymandias-like projects.
Well, there's entire ghost cities and tens of billions of empty apartments, and many will never, ever pay back the borrowings. And I think you were alluding to Evergrande, which is a Chinese property company. What happened last year was China brought in these measures that were targeting the property sector to try to reduce their dependence on this particular driver of growth, which was like 20 to 30%, depending on who you believe. And so they tried to rein in excessive debt and improve housing affordability, which has a familiar ring to Australia in many ways. But this created serious problems for the real estate firms, and particularly the Evergrande Group, which has borrowed around about, I think it's about $300 billion US dollars. And essentially, the government sort of backed off because they were forced to intervene because they feared social instability and social disorder. And the real problem for China is property constitutes probably three quarters of household wealth. So they've tried to protect buyers, but they're still trying to juggle, I think, this horrible problem of their reliance on certain sectors and the problems that it's bringing.
I understand there's also concerns at the moment about the effect of China's adherence to its strict zero COVID policy.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And it may come as a surprise to some that China has actually got some sort of restriction in at least 73 of its 100 largest cities. And Shanghai, for instance, which accounts for, I don't know, somewhere between 4 and 5% of Chinese economic activity, has best been described as a ghost city. I mean, I remember the Pudong district quite well. It's completely empty. And this has a flow-on effect not only to China, but to the rest of the world, because every time they get a COVID outbreak, they close down things like factories and ports, and that affects supply chains throughout the world.
Does China have an issue with its own oligarchs?
Oh, yes. I think Deng Xiaoping very, very early in the piece made two observations, which is, one, it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice, which was his illusion that socialism wasn't necessarily the only way to wealth. And the other was that he was quite happy for some people to get rich quicker than others. And that's backfired in a spectacular way, because there is a massive inequality growing in China with a similar oligarch class to, say, in Russia, and indeed, I would argue, in Australia, in the UK, and in fact, most of the world. So they have a problem with that, no doubt about that. And I think Mr. Xi, President Xi, is quite concerned about that in terms of how that's, A, perceived by the mass of Chinese people, but also to actually deal with that problem in a way which doesn't cut off the private sector, which is important to China.
Of course, Xi doesn't do what Putin does and amass personal wealth, does he?
Just looking at Xi when he's seen with capitalists in China, he almost has his nose screwed up and his lips pursed. So I think that there's obviously a personal antipathy. And certainly, to be very honest, I have never seen any evidence of personal wealth gathering by Xi, but I wouldn't know, because that could be well the case. I just simply don't.
China's leaders are very aware that they need to rebalance their economy, but you argue they face a number of limitations in what they can actually do.
Well, I think that's right, because let's start with the one that everybody trots out, that China has $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. But I think their resources are actually grossly overestimated, because that $3 trillion may not be adequate. For a start, a lot of it's invested in infrastructure and particularly in the Belt and Roads Initiative. And some of that's been lent to such exciting places as Sri Lanka, which has its financial difficulties. So they're not going to be able to get a lot of that money back. So that's the first problem. But the second problem, which I think is deeper, is the policy trade-offs they now face are extremely difficult. I'll give you an example. They know they have to move away from their model of this massive investment in infrastructure, property, and industrial capacity. But if they start to rein that back, then there's going to be job losses, which risks social instability. But they also know that if they don't do that, the problem will get deeper because of rising debt. Now, in China, there's quite a degree of concern about emissions and environmental factors. But the problem is, if they bring in Western-style controls, they become cost uncompetitive globally in certain goods. And so growth slows down. So one way, if they don't do anything, they choke to death. If they do something, they starve to death. So there's these trade-offs that are going on. And the other critical, there are two other critical ones. One is, they want the individuals in China to reduce savings, because they save an enormous portion, like 40-50% of their incomes. But the reason they do that is they don't have a welfare net anywhere near what, say, a country like Australia or even the United States has. So,
and of course, China's rapidly aging population is a big issue.
You anticipated what I was just going to say. They've got a massive demographic problem. Its workforce has probably peaked, and that aging population is going to cause problems. In fact, coming back to your point about COVID, one of the interesting things is what you discover is one of the problems of COVID is the high portion of aged people, the lack of hospital capacity, and the fact that many of these people haven't still, for whatever reason, been vaccinated. And that's part of the problem. So there's a lot of these issues that they have to deal with.
Going back to Belt and Road, it's costing them a mozza, as you say, much of it won't be paid back. Is this a case of imperial overreach?
Look, what they wanted to do was keep their industries going. The Belt and Roads Initiative is very interestingly structured. So they lend money to the other country to build things. But generally what happens is they actually are forced to use Chinese firms and Chinese labor. So if you go through Africa where the BRI initiative can be seen, or in South Asia, you find these whole colonies of Chinese workers. So it's almost like a make work scheme, except it's taking place overseas. Now, this has a whole lot of problems, one of which it creates massive local resentment. And there was a very famous case in Zambia when the local Chinese manager who treated local workers badly was actually beaten to death. So there's a lot of issues around the BRI, and it'll be interesting to see whether they get any benefits from it.
The voice of Sajid Das, financial markets expert and regular economics commentator, on the Little Wireless program, and we're talking about China's economic trends and what they mean for Australia. Now, she's campaigning for a third term on this goal of achieving common prosperity. How is that working for him?
Look, he definitely is very serious about this, but I think a little bit of perspective is needed on what Xi is facing. The Chinese Communist Party's legitimacy rests on competence and self-discipline, and there's this inherent trade-off that they made, which is that the party maintains a monopoly on political power, but they allow people's lifestyles and living standards to improve. So it's absolutely crucial that he continues to make progress on that front. And the problem for Xi was when he came to power in 2012, the Chinese Communist Party was widely seen as a kleptocracy that was only really keeping the well-connected wealthy. So some of his fairly draconian anti-corruption programs are really targeted at reducing that, at least in a perceptual sense, but also, as you say, to increase common prosperity. And one of the interesting things is, I noticed you were talking about Clive Palmer. One of Xi's real messages has been that the rich should give back to society. As you know, Clive Palmer often espouses similar principles. But this campaign that he's talking about now threatens very powerful interests within China. And so some of his reactions to this, some of the authoritarianism as perceived by the West, is really trying to sort of thread the needle in terms of the different constituencies and the things he has to do. And the other thing is that Xi has been shaped pretty much by the memories of the chaotic collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And so that just reinforces the tendency for authoritarian rule. But he's trying desperately to get in technology, to leverage whatever China has, try to get access to R&D on computing, robotics. But what this means is that the Chinese Communist Party at the same time is very reluctant to reduce its power and control over what they see as crucial economic levers. And so the West keeps berating them that they're not opening up, and they won't, except on their own terms. And parallel to that, Xi is trying desperately to manage certain nationalistic sort of trends. And this has come to be called the wolf warrior diplomacy, which is a term that comes from I think it's a 2017 Chinese action film. But he's very concerned that he is seen to be standing up and reversing China's centuries of humiliation, which includes reclaiming lost territory, especially Taiwan. And that's part of his historical legacy, and also ensuring that the West accepts China's rise. So he's got an agenda, which is huge. There's no other way to describe it. It's just huge.
Now, in the short time we have left, it's time to turn to Australia. How deeply is our economic success, such as it is, tied to China?
Well, some simple statistics. China directly accounts for about 40% of Australian exports. The next highest is the US and Europe, which are both around 10%. Australia imports about 30% of all that it gets from overseas. The next highest is the United States and Europe, again, 20%. It's the largest single source of international students to Australia and also the second largest inbound tourism market. It's actually very, very big. And to give you an idea of how important it is, let's take the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, Australia and every politician is claiming that they did very well and Australia did very well. And it's true, they did very well. But there's a single factor behind that. It's China. Because in 2021, because of high iron ore prices, those iron ore exports constituted 10% of the entire Australian economy. It was so large that it completely offset all the losses from loss of international students, tourism, and immigration. So it's very, very important, and it's probably irreplaceable.
I didn't realise that Chinese foreign investment here is very modest, under 5%, you say?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. It lags behind what comes from, say, North America, Europe, or Japan. But because they've invested in certain strategic sectors like farmland or ports or mines, it gets much greater headline coverage than the actual numbers should indicate.
What effect has our spat with China had on our economy thus far, Dash?
Look, there's been tariffs, anti-dumping and anti-subsidy measures, but to some extent we've been able to find other markets for that, though with lower prices. But the interesting thing will be longer term. There's a couple of things. Whether they continue to import particularly iron ore from us at the same rate depends on whether they continue the aggressive infrastructure programs. And it's clearly they're looking for alternative supplies. One is in Guinea, they have this huge mine called Simandou, which has roughly about somewhere around 2.5 billion tons of high-grade iron ore reserves. And it's seen by China as a way of reducing dependency on Australia. Also, we'll have to see over time whether the mainland students and tourists return, because despite what Australia thinks, other countries have beaches, seafood and Gucci stores, and as well as universities.
Now, is it possible for Australia to straddle both sides of the fence when it comes to our relationships with China and the US, does?
I think it's very difficult. I think Joe Bielke-Peterson, the former Queensland Premier, once said it's like running along a barbed wire fence with a foot on either side. And it's neither elegant nor probably safe. The problem is we have these conflicting sort of positions. One is economically we're tied to Asia and particularly China, but politically, culturally, et cetera, for a whole host of reasons, we are very Western in our approach. And that's going to create enormous problems. It's schizophrenia is going to cause enormous problems for us going forward.
Is Ukraine a factor?
Oh, definitely, because and this is part of what we were just talking about, Australia has obviously sided with the West on certain principles. And the problem for us is that China is obviously, at least appears on the surface, to be in the Russian camp. Now, if for any reason, for example, the US was to sanction China and Chinese businesses, the process of sanctions would mean, through what we call secondary sanctions, that is, we would have difficulty dealing with some of these Chinese businesses or paying them or receiving money from them, which would have a very significant effect on our activities in terms of trade. And I think the real issue here is there's a 19th century British statesman, Lord Palmerston. He once said countries did not have eternal allies or perpetual enemies, just permanent interests. And for the moment, I think Australia is refusing to choose between history and geography. And whether that can continue, I don't know.
The incomparably eloquent Sajid Das, former banker and financial markets expert, and I'm delighted he's a regular here on our Little Wireless program. Latest book, Fortune's Fool, Australia's Choices, published by Monash University Press. And we'll have him back just before the election to talk about our addiction to houses and holes.